From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My father has been in prison for the past 3.5 years, and on Monday a judge sentenced him to another 1.5 years. And he gave him the maximum sentence, even though a jury found him not guilty of, you know, most of the counts against him back in December, and they were hung on the rest of the charges.
Two daughters speak about the plight of their fathers. Leila Alarian is the daughter of Palestinian professor and activist Sami Alarian. Wiam Hamouda is the daughter of Samia Hamouda, who also remains in jail despite being acquitted of all charges. Then Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert addresses thousands of journalists and President Bush at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An Armenian passenger plane has crashed off Russia's Black Sea coast, killing all 113 people on board. Armenian airline officials say they suspect the crash was due to bad weather. On Capitol Hill here in the United States, Republicans have dropped a proposal to provide consumers with $100 rebates to offset rising gas costs. The idea was floated last week amidst a growing public outcry over record gas prices. The abandonment of the rebate plan comes just one day after Republicans said they would also drop a tax proposal opposed by the oil industry and other business leaders. Republican House Speaker Dennis Hastert said Republicans would focus their efforts on opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Hastert made the announcement after meeting with ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson. Speaking in Washington, New York Senator Chuck Schumer criticized the Republicans' ties to the oil industry.
The last person in the world you'd want to make oil policy in America is George Bush, because George Bush believes in his bones that what's good for ExxonMobil is good for America. That's how he was raised. That's how he was brought up. He can't do anything against. And that's why the policies that he and his Republican leadership have come up with are sort of a joke.
New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. In Iraq, 15 people were killed, 13 wounded earlier today when a suicide bomber attacked a recruitment line outside a Fallujah police station. Meanwhile, police in Baghdad said they've found the bodies of at least 14 men who've been tied up and shot dead. According to Reuters, Baghdad's main morgue received at least 65 bodies on Monday and Tuesday. Meanwhile, an unidentified Iraqi ambulance worker was killed Tuesday when he was shot by a group of American security contractors. The worker's colleague, Abu Ali, described the attack.
We were driving here to deliver a case to the hospital when a bomb went off close to a passing convoy of Americans. The Americans opened fire on him, shooting him in the heart. Their sniper shot him twice and one of them in his heart. What is his crime? We are ambulance drivers who help people during attacks. What have we done wrong?
That was Abu Ali, the colleague of an unidentified Iraqi ambulance worker shot dead Tuesday by U.S. security contractors. In other Iraq news, two German engineers were freed Tuesday after nearly 16 weeks in captivity. The men were abducted in late January from an oil refinery north of Baghdad. In Italy, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has abandoned his bid to cling to power following his loss in last month's national elections. Berlusconi submitted his resignation Tuesday. Romano Prodi, leader of the winning center-left coalition, is expected to be named prime minister in the coming weeks. In Mexico, President Vicente Fox is expected to sign into law a measure that decriminalizes the possession of small amounts of drugs, including marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. The measure was approved by the Mexican Senate Friday over the strong objection of U.S. officials. Back in the United States, the release of thousands of declassified military documents is raising new questions about the role of senior Army commanders at the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal. According to the ACLU, the documents show Army Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the former top U.S. military commander in Iraq, urged his troops to, quote, go to the outer limits to extract information from prisoners. Previously released documents have linked Sanchez to the use of army dogs during interrogations. The Bush administration is coming under criticism from consumer and health advocates over a new Federal Trade Commission and Health and Human Services report that advocates say is too lax on food marketing and childhood obesity. Gary Ruskin, executive director of Commercial Alert, said, quote, "The junk food industry will be thrilled that the government recommends no federal restrictions on junk food marketing to children, despite the continued worsening of the childhood obesity epidemic. The report shows once again that the Bush administration cares more about the profits of the food industry than the health of our children," he said. Meanwhile, the foundation run by former President Bill Clinton has announced a deal with the country's major beverage companies to end the sale of soft drinks in public schools. Under the agreement, companies including Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and Cadbury Schweppes have agreed to sell only low or non-fattening drinks to elementary and middle schools. Diet sodas will be sold only in high schools. An estimated 35 million students will be affected by the deal. And finally, in Boston, a free speech controversy has erupted at Brandeis University over the removal of an exhibition featuring the paintings of Palestinian youths. The exhibit's 17 paintings depicted the young artist's perspectives on life under Israeli military occupation. But just 4 days into a two-week run, the exhibit was removed by Brandeis officials after several complaints from students. A university spokesperson said the school would consider remounting the paintings if they were to appear alongside paintings showing an Israeli perspective. The exhibition was curated by an Israeli Jewish student who said she wanted to showcase a Palestinian perspective on campus. The student, Lior Halperin, said, quote, "This was an opportunity to bring to Brandeis the Palestinian voice that is not spoken or heard through an Israeli or an American Jew, but directly delivered from Palestinians. Obviously, that was just too much for Brandeis," she said. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The case of Palestinian professor and activist Sami Alarian took another turn this week when a federal judge in Florida sentenced him to another year and a half in prison. Alarian has been at the center of one of the most closely watched and controversial post-9/11 prosecutions. He was arrested February 2003 and accused of being a leader of the militant group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The government's case against Alarian included 11 years of FBI wiretaps and searches, 3 years of trial preparation by federal prosecutors, millions of dollars in costs, and a six-month trial that ended last December. At the end of it all, the jury failed to return a single guilty verdict on any of the 53 criminal counts brought against Alarian and three co-defendants. One of those co-defendants, Sami Hammoudeh, will join us on the phone from Florida jail in a few minutes. He remains in prison despite being acquitted of all the charges against him. Alarian himself was acquitted on 8 counts. The jury hung on 9 others. Last month, Alarian signed a plea agreement with prosecutors to plead guilty to a lesser version of one of the deadlocked charges, namely that he helped members of Palestinian Islamic Jihad with immigration and legal matters at a time before the State Department designated it a terrorist group. At his sentencing on Monday, U.S. District Judge James Moody ignored the recommendation of prosecutors and defense attorneys for a lower sentence and gave Alarian as much prison time as possible under the plea deal, 57 months, followed by deportation. With credit for time served, Alarian will spend another 18 months behind bars. He's been in prison for over 3 years now, much of it in solitary confinement. It's not clear where the government would deport Alarian to. He is Palestinian, born in Kuwait and raised mostly in Egypt. He's lived in the United States for the past 30 years and holds permanent residency status. His 5 children were born in the United States. They're all American citizens. We're joined in our firehouse studio by one of them. Layla Alarian is Sami's eldest daughter. She is just about to graduate from Columbia University's School of Journalism. In a studio in Tampa, we're joined by Linda Moreno, Sami Alarian's attorney. And we're also joined on the phone by John Sugg, senior editor for Creative Loafing, an Atlanta-based alternative weekly newspaper who's closely followed the Alarian case for the past 10 years. We will begin with Layla Alarian. Can you describe what happened the day of the sentencing? You were there?
Yes, I was. Basically, we all went in, and there was this air of reconciliation. Everyone was really expecting a swift resolution to this painful ordeal. And my father gave a very beautiful speech talking about his faith in the democratic system and the judicial system and how it was reinforced throughout this process. Our lawyer, Linda Moreno, also spoke very eloquently and asked that the judge give my father time served and release him. And unfortunately, the judge kind of, you know, gave this tirade, berating my father and mentioning things that were completely disproven in court, that the jury basically said were not true and acquitted my father of. And it was just a very disgraceful and, you know, just very undignified display.
Linda Moreno, can you amplify on what the judge said and the significance of not following the suggestion, well, it's not necessarily a surprise of defense attorney, you, but of the prosecution?
It's important to note, Amy, that the plea agreement in this case that Dr. Alarian signed very specifically dealt with a watered-down version of a particular conspiracy count. And what's most important to remember about that is that the United States government, in that plea agreement, agreed that this was not a crime of violence, that there were no victims to the crime that Dr. Alarian was pleading guilty to, either direct or proximate. This from the same United States attorneys who had gotten up 11 months earlier and had promised an American jury that they were going to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that Dr. Alarian was the North American head and the most powerful person of Islamic Jihad and a terrorist financier. So they were very clear that what we were agreeing to had nothing to do with violence. The jury repudiated all of the evidence of violence, which was at the heart of the government's case. And what's interesting is that after the sentencing, some of the jurors who sat on the trial were interviewed. And in particular, one of the jurors who was hanging for conviction said that she did not agree with the judge's comments and that she repudiated all of the violence in the case. So the judge really went out on his own and ignored the jury, I think undermined the jury's verdict, ignored the recommendation of the United States government, and decided to base his sentencing on facts that were not proven, and I think that were somewhat intemperate.
The language that the judge used, sounds like it echoed some of what one of the government informants said on the stand, Linda Moreno.
Well, one of the informants, this was a paid FBI snitch who was thoroughly discredited. In cross-examination, we got him to agree that he lied in various documents, resumes, applications for work, and he would describe these lies in colors of a rainbow. That was a white lie, that was a black lie, that was a red lie. So he was thoroughly discredited, but he made a very emotional statement when he was on the stand. He said that Dr. Alarian sent his son to Duke University while he sent others to be blown up. We felt that the judge eerily paraphrased this discredited snitch on the stand, and it was of concern to us.
Can you describe your experience in the courtroom, Leila Alarian? You are both a daughter. You're also graduating as a journalism student. You're a journalist. You were there with your two older siblings. Two of the younger children were not there. Yeah. What was the courtroom like? Who comes to this trial day after day?
Well, we were grateful to have, you know, a great number of our supporters in the Tampa community from both the Christian and the Muslim communities. And, you know, it was just a very, like I said, just an era of reconciliation, and everyone was really looking forward to moving on with life. And you know, we can even see on the government side that they're ready to just put this all behind them. And
did your mother walk out of the courtroom
she did
as the
walk
judge
out.
Was speaking?
Yes. I mean, we thought it was a very strong statement, but she just couldn't bear to listen to those, you know, horrible lies that he was spewing. And you know, so it was, I mean, it definitely wasn't easy to hear him lambast my father and use those lies and smear him in that way. You know, it was.
John Sugg, could you put this in the context of the years that you have covered this case, reporting for Creative Loafing?
Well, I think you have to look at what's gone on from the very beginning. And this started in 1994 with a television report by self-described terrorism expert Steve Emerson, who most people consider to be a front for Israel's Likud party in what he does. And I think that the effort has always been to silence Sami Alarian. Alarian, as you just said, the government couldn't prove anything about him of any real significance. What he did in the specifics of the plea agreement was so incidental to the government's claims as to be ridiculous. I think it's also worth noting a few other things. Alberto Gonzalez was in Tampa a few days before the sentencing. Paul Perez, the U.S. attorney there, never made an appearance in court until sentencing. And then, of course, he raced for the TV cameras to declare a victory. I mean, I think that despite I think the prosecution knew all along that this was going to be the outcome and agreed to a light sentence, knowing that the game plan would be different at the end. Alarian's been silenced. He had something important to say. He tried to say it to everybody who would listen. And just like you were saying earlier in the show at Brandeis University, only one side, you know, in this dispute gets an airing in America. And I think that that's very dangerous to our democracy.
Leila Alarian.
I completely agree with that. And even in the judge's comments during the sentencing, you know, he kind of revealed his whole myopic view of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in that there's only Israeli victims and that all Palestinians are perpetrators and that are terrorists. And it was just a very disturbing thing to hear coming from a federal judge.
Well, you know, one thing that I heard during the closing arguments was when the prosecution introduced a document that mentioned UN Resolution 242, the resolution that calls for return to the borders, the original borders, the judge would not even allow the defense to explain to the jury what 242 meant. The judge would not let any testimony about the plight of the Palestinians be entered into this trial. Had Martin Luther King been on trial, he would not have been able to have mentioned lynchings and Jim Crow. That's how ridiculous this courtroom was.
We're talking to John Sugg, senior editor for Creative Loafing, who has been following this trial. It's a newspaper based in Tampa and Atlanta, an alternative weekly newspaper. Leila Alarian, daughter of Sami Alarian, as well as Linda Moreno, the attorney for Sami Alarian. Can you talk, Linda Moreno, exactly about the plea bargain? What did Sami Alarian plead guilty to?
Dr. Alarian pled guilty to a conspiracy, which is an agreement. A conspiracy to provide services to associates of the Islamic Jihad. And essentially what he did, for the most part, was assist in the legal defense of his brother-in-law, Mazen al-Najjar, in Mazen's own unconstitutional detention hearing. He also helped associates, colleagues with the immigration process. So this was a conspiracy charge that Dr. Alarian pled to. I will tell you that this plea agreement was something that was vigorously negotiated on both sides. And there were certain things that Sami Alarian would never have pled guilty to, the first of which was any responsibility whatsoever for any violence.
Weren't there a lot of images of violence shown during the trial?
There were. The government was allowed to present videos of the bus bombings, live testimony of victims or survivors, eyewitnesses of certain bombings around the occupied territories. Indeed, Elisa Flatow's father testified. We did not cross-examine any of those witnesses because our position was...
She was killed. She was killed in a suicide bombing attack?
She was, and her father, who testifies apparently at many of these trials, sought to try to attribute some responsibility to Dr. Alarian through his testimony. So the government put on what they believed was their very potent sexy, if you will, violent case, which the jury completely repudiated. The jury felt that Dr. Larian had nothing to do with that violence. And we felt that was a very powerful message back to the government. They still tried in the plea negotiations to have the violence inserted. In fact, at one point, they wanted Dr. Larian to plead guilty and pay restitution for all victims of violence, of conduct that was even uncharged. That was immediately, of course, rejected and rebuked. And Dr. Larian was perfectly willing and able to represent himself, if need be, against the United States government. And I dare say he would have won the second time around. This plea was an effort for closure, closure for the family, a family who has suffered and been traumatized, not only for the last 3 years, but really more for the last decade with this campaign and witch hunt that has gone on in the Tampa community, especially by the newspaper, the Tampa Tribune. So this was an attempt for closure and indeed for reconciliation. It was unfortunate that it ended the way it did, but I want to tell you I was very proud of my client and his very moving statements to the court. We felt that we ended on a very positive note.
Linda Marino, I want to thank you for being with us. Lawyer for Sami Alarian joining us from PBS station in Tampa, WEDU. Layla Alarian, stay with us, daughter of Sami Alarian here in New York. She just flew up from the sentencing. John Sugg will remain with us on the line, and we'll be joined by the co-defendant of Sami Alarian. We'll be joined by Sami Hammouda, who remains in jail right now, is detained by ICE, Immigration and Customs and Enforcement, and will speak with his daughter in Jordan. Stay with us.
جسد أشبه شيء جسد أشبه شيء بالخيال وفؤادي عن هوى وفؤادي عن هواكم غير سالي.
Amer Tawfiq here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to the case of one of Dr. Sami Alarian's co-defendants, Sami Hammouda. In December, he was found not guilty of all charges against him, and the judge in the case ordered his immediate release from jail. Hammouda expected to be immediately deported along with his wife and six children. The deportation was part of an agreement in exchange for pleading guilty to tax and immigration violations in a separate case in which he received no jail time. But officials from Immigration and Customs Enforcement took him into custody, saying initially that its standard of innocence was different from the jury's. A spokeswoman for the agency said they believed Hammouda had ties to terrorists, despite his acquittal. Nearly 4 months after being acquitted of all terrorism charges, he remains behind bars. Sami Hammouda joins us on the line right now from the Manatee County Jail in Bradenton, Florida. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
We'll listen as carefully as we can. The line isn't very good. Why are you still in jail?
Well, because the whole case is based, what we can call is the abuse of power. The United States government is not only violating the international laws and disregarding them, but they are violating and disregarding the civil rights and the human rights inside the United States. And my case is one of these violations. And if I want to talk about my case, it's going to take me hours and hours, because the whole case was based on fabrication, violation, I mean, fabrication, manipulation of facts, inventing even facts and events that did not even take place. The special agent who directed this case said things that never happened, never occurred. And he even, in his testimony, he changed my My name in Arabic is Samih. Samih Hammoudi. So he changed my name to Hami, which rhymes as Sami. And whenever he was talking about Sami, he will combine me there because he had no evidence whatsoever even to invite me.
Samih Hammoudi, we're having trouble hearing you, so we're going to ask you to call back. But while we go through that, we're going to ask John Sugg to talk about your case as well, one that he also has covered.
Well, what you have is sort of a repeat of what started a lot of this case, and that was the illegal imprisonment of Palestinians. In the first case, it was Sami Alarian's brother-in-law, Mazen al-Najjar, who was held for about 4 years on secret evidence. Interestingly, in that case, a federal immigration judge, twice reviewed the secret evidence and ordered al-Najjar released, a decision that was ratified by Janet Reno. Twice, prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office recommended that there be no prosecution brought against al-Arian and the other defendants, and they were ignored under the Bush administration. The prosecution was brought. We're talking about an administration that, as the Boston Globe reported last week, where President Bush has broken something like 750 laws. I mean, this administration, it defines as illegal what's ever convenient, and that's what's happening to Hammoudi right now. He should be out of jail. He should be allowed to leave the country. He's being held for no reason at all. The government cannot articulate a valid reason why he's being held.
We're also joined on the phone from Jordan by Wiam Hammoudi, who is the daughter of Samih Hammoudi. Can you talk about how you ended up, speaking to us from Ramallah, how you ended up in Ramallah when you were staying in Florida as your father remained in jail?
Well, they had agreed to a separate plea deal, like you said earlier, and part of that was deportation. And it was supposed to happen after a terrorism trial ended and the sentencing was done, if there was any sentencing. In my father's case, obviously, since he was acquitted, there was no sentencing hearing. Then we were given different dates. It kept getting postponed, saying that they needed clearance from my father and whatnot. And we were given three separate promises, promising us that he would be on an airplane with us. And then they sent my mother a letter saying that we had until February 9th to leave the country, or that they would take whatever measures that were at their disposal against her. So we bought the tickets and left, and our lawyer and us were also told that my father would be joining us. But when we got to the airport, he didn't show up, and the immigration official that was there told us that he wouldn't be on the plane with us that day, but he would be joining us within 72 hours. So we got to Jordan and stayed in Jordan for about a week waiting for him because we kept getting different promises. The last thing, he told us to buy him a ticket and that as long as we bought him the ticket, they would let him go or whatever. But obviously that didn't happen either. And after that, we came to Ramallah through Jordan. And we're here now with all our family, just waiting for him to come home.
We have Samih Hammoudi on the line with us again from jail. Have they given you any indication if they will release you?
No, they won't. I mean, my attorney keeps trying to call them, and every time they give him just a cold shoulder. And he's having even trouble to communicate with the government officials.
John Sugg, is there any redress? Can you compare this to any other cases that you have tried? And in your interviews with the prosecution, with the government, what are you hearing?
Well, I think that there's reasons that they're holding Hammoudi that have nothing to do with whether he's guilty or innocent of anything. I think that same reason, same mentality why, we hold scores of prisoners at Guantanamo, many of whom we know had no involvement in terrorism. You know, this is one thing that's important to also keep in context in this case. Linda Marino sort of addressed it, but almost all of the activities of these men, certainly of Alarian, occurred before 1996, and it occurred in the late 80s, early 90s. The Tampa Tribune that she mentioned is very adept at failing to mention the time context of all that, because most of what they were doing was perfectly legal, First Amendment-protected stuff. Terrorists don't go out there and try to draw attention to themselves. They don't work with the FBI, as Al Arian did, trying to create a better understanding of his cause and of Islam and other things. Terrorists don't draw attention to themselves like that. I mean, whatever they were doing, they were trying to state their point of view. You can agree or disagree with their point of view, but all along, this has been a case of our government making a frontal assault on civil liberties. And with Hammoudi, it's one more extension of that. And that's I don't think that there is any reason. I think the government's embarrassed. The government was terribly embarrassed by the verdicts in this case. They couldn't prove a thing. And so they're just exacting retribution now on these guys to make, you know, for retribution, revenge. And I think that that's a very poor thing for our government to be engaged
in. John Sugg, Professor Alarian's indictment in 2003 was hailed by then Attorney General John Ashcroft as one of the first triumphs of the Patriot Act. The government's case was built on hundreds of documents, including thousands of hours of wiretap telephone calls, intercepted emails, faxes, bank records gathered over a decade.
Right. Well, 400,000 wiretaps, and the government could find only a few hundred that pertained to anything at all. It was so ridiculous. With Hammoudi, for example, the government claimed that every time the word family was mentioned, that it referred to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. I mean, these prosecutors had watched too many Godfather movies, okay? So when Hammoudi would call up his elderly father and mother and ask about how the family was doing, the government says that they were talking about Islamic Jihad business. I mean, that's how stupid this was. The Patriot Act, almost all the information, all of the information I'm told, but give them a break, almost all the information the government had for years. There was nothing new added by the Patriot Act in this case. That was a fraud, you know, perpetuated by the government to justify the prosecution.
Leila Alarian.
Also, I wanted to say, to put this case in context, in 2003 in the first indictment, also in the superseding indictment, there were 34 counts against my father, and he was acquitted. Or the charges were dismissed against all of them but one, which was extremely watered down in the plea agreement. So, you know, for the government to hail this case is just completely, you know, hypocritical and false.
What has this done to your family? And Wiam, I want to ask you the same in Ramallah.
I mean, it's definitely devastated us. My younger siblings have basically grown up during the most important time of their lives. They're 15 and 12 right now, without a father. And you know, it's just one of the worst possible things that can happen to a family, is to lose their father and to see him being held in such horrible conditions.
You are all American citizens.
Yes,
your brother went to Duke, was an aide to Congressman Bonnier at the time. You are now a journalist. How has it shaped you and your view and how you will cover things?
I guess seeing the media coverage in our case and kind of all the false things that are printed about my father and about the trial, it's just made me sort of cynical about kind of, I mean, I'd like to be the kind of journalist that makes sure that everything that I publish or print is 100% true, but it's just, to me, jarring. I was just thinking about it this morning on the way here, that to see all of the, I guess, misperceptions or about the case that are printed day in and day out, and how they're taken as fact by people who've never attended the trial, just reprinting falsities that my father was a leader in the PIJ, or that he engaged in fundraising, or that he, you know, funded the organization, et cetera.
You know Wea?
Yes, I do.
Did you both go to the trial together?
Yes, yeah.
Wea, how has this affected your family?
I mean, along the same lines, it's really devastated us a lot emotionally. And, I mean, I have younger siblings. Like, my youngest brother is turning 5 in 2 weeks. So, I mean, we have 3 kids that are 10 and under. And, you know, they've spent 3 years of their lives without their father, and it's really hard explaining to them why. And especially with the youngest two, because, I mean, 5 and 7, when everything happened, my brother wasn't even 2 years old yet. And, I mean, for the first month or so, every time the door would open, he would run out of the house saying, blah, 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 waiting for my dad to get there because that's what he was used to. And then it just after a while, he stopped saying it because I guess he got used to him not seeing him. And the expectation wasn't there anymore.
Sami Hammoud, the last word goes to you as you speak to us detained in Bradenton, Florida.
Well, I will just say what the jurors found after 5 months of the government presentation. I mean, when the 12 jurors went into deliberation, they took several hours to silently examine the evidence. Then the 4th person asked for a show of hands to determine the verdict on Hammoud. And without hesitation, all 12, they have their hands up for acquittal on all counts. And one of the jurors said, without talking about it, we had each made up our minds. I mean, they even did not discuss what the government had said about me because they did not believe anything. Everything was fabrication. Everything was a mere lie. Fat lies. This is what they did. And this is what they are insisting on doing to me and to continue my ordeal. Only because I am a stateless Palestinian that nobody is going to care about me. Nobody is going to talk about my case. I am not a Christian, I am not a Jew, I am not a citizen of a powerful country that can ask about my destiny, about why the American government is abusing my rights. And I am very upset, I am very frustrated, and I think this American government now is taking the United States into a very dangerous situation where they are violating everything that belongs to human dignity and to human rights. They are violating all of the traditions of the United States. They are violating everything human in this life. They are turning this country to an ugly country for everyone who's observing what they are doing in Iraq, in Afghanistan, here inside the United States, and everywhere. I mean, in an era where people are opening up to each other, nations are coming closer to each other, they are thinking about building walls, and they are encouraging Israel to establish a wall between the Jews and the Palestinians instead of encouraging the Palestinians and the Israelis to talk to each other and to establish enduring peace between them.
Sami Hammoud, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And Leila, last question, where will your father be deported to after he serves this year and a half?
We're not actually sure of that yet, and we appeal to any country that's willing to take a stateless Palestinian refugee to give him a home.
Leila Alarian, thank you for joining us here in New York, Columbia journalism student, daughter of Sami Alarian. Wiam Hammouda, the daughter of Sami Hammouda, both on the line with us. Wiam waiting for her father in Ramallah. Sami Hammouda speaking to us from the Manatee County Jail in Bradenton, Florida. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Stephen Colbert at the White House Correspondents Dinner. Amr Taufik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, on Friday night, over 2,000 journalists, politicians, Washington insiders gathered for the White House Correspondents Association annual dinner. President Bush was there, took part in a skit with a presidential impersonator, Steve Bridges. And then there was the featured entertainer, Stephen Colbert, the host of Comedy Central fake news program, The Colbert Report. If you followed how the corporate press covered the night, you might not have even realized that Colbert spoke. But he did give a talk that repeatedly mocked the president and the press for its failings. According to the media watch group Media Matters, subsequent press coverage focused only on Bush's lighthearted comedy while omitting mention of Colbert's blistering performance. On May 1st, all three major networks played clips of Bush's routine on their morning shows, but ignored Colbert entirely. CNN's American Morning did the same. New York Times' initial coverage of that night omitted any reference to Stephen Colbert. Several media critics have questioned why the press ignored Colbert's criticism of the president. At the same time, the Colbert performance has been one of the most talked-about topics on the internet, and today the New York Times did do a piece on that. Well, today we'll give you a chance to hear comedian Stephen Colbert and to watch him in his own words. This is what he said at the White House Correspondents Association dinner.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Before I begin, I've been asked to make an announcement. Whoever parked 14 black bulletproof SUVs out front, could you please move them? They're blocking in 14 other black bulletproof SUVs, and they need to get out. Wow. Wow, what an honor. The White House Correspondents' Dinner. To actually, to sit here at the same table with my hero, George W. Bush. To be this close to the man. I feel like I'm dreaming. Somebody pinch me. You know what? I'm a pretty sound sleeper. That may not be enough. Somebody shoot me in the face. Is he really not here tonight? Damn it. The one guy who could have helped. By the way, before I get started, if anybody needs anything else at their tables, just speak slowly and clearly into your table numbers. Someone from the NSA will be right over with a cocktail. Mark Smith, ladies and gentlemen of the press corps, Madam First Lady, Mr. President, my name is Stephen Colbert, and tonight it is my privilege to celebrate this president, because we're not so different, he and I. We both get it. Guys like us, we're not some brainiacs on the nerd patrol. We're not members of the Factinista. We go straight from the gut, right, sir? That's where the truth lies, right down here in the gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your gut than you have in your head? You can look it up. Now, I know some of you are going to say, I did look it up, and that's not true. That's because you looked it up in a book. Next time, look it up in your gut. I did. My gut tells me that's how our nervous system works. Every night on my show, The Colbert Report, I speak straight from the gut, okay? I give people the truth unfiltered by rational argument. I call it the no-fact zone. Fox News, I hold a copyright on that term. I'm a simple man with a simple mind. I hold a simple set of beliefs that I live by. Number one, I believe in America. I believe it exists. My gut tells me I live there. I feel that it extends from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and I strongly believe it has 50 states. And I cannot wait to see how the Washington Post spins that one tomorrow. I believe in democracy. I believe democracy is our greatest export, at least until China figures out a way to stamp it out of plastic for 3 cents a unit. As a matter of fact, Ambassador Zhou Wenzhong, welcome. Your great country makes our happy meals possible. I said it's a celebration. I believe the government that governs best is the government that governs least. And by these standards, we have set up a fabulous government in Iraq. I believe in pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. I believe it is possible. I saw this guy do it once in Cirque du Soleil. It was magical. And though I am a committed Christian, I believe that everyone has the right to their own religion, be you Hindu, Jewish, or Muslim. I believe there are infinite paths to accepting Jesus Christ as your personal savior. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe it's yogurt. But I refuse to believe it's not butter. Most of all, I believe in this president. Now, I know there's some polls out there saying that this man has a 32% approval rating. But guys like us, we don't pay attention to the polls. We know that polls are just a collection of statistics that reflect what people are thinking in reality. And reality has a well-known liberal bias. So, Mr. President, please pay no attention to the people who say the glass is half full. 32% means the glass. It's important to set up your jokes properly, sir. Sir, pay no attention to the people who say the glass is half empty, because 32% means it's two-thirds empty. There's still some liquid in that glass, is my point. But I wouldn't drink it. Last third is usually backwash. Okay. Look, folks, my point is that I don't believe this is a low point in this presidency. I believe it is just a lull before a comeback. I mean, it's like the movie Rocky, all right? The president in this case is Rocky Balboa, and Apollo Creed is everything else in the world. It's the 10th round. He's bloodied. His corner man, Mick, who in this case I guess would be the vice president, he's yelling, "Cut me, Dick, cut me." And every time he falls, everyone says, "Stay down, Rock, stay down." But does he stay down? No. Like Rocky, he gets back up, and in the end, he actually loses in the first movie. Okay, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. The point is, it is the heartwarming story of a man who is repeatedly punched in the face. So don't pay attention to the approval ratings that say that 68% of Americans disapprove of the job this man is doing. I ask you this, does that not also logically mean that 68% approve of the job he's not doing? Think about it. I haven't. I stand by this man. I stand by this man because he stands for things. Not only for things, he stands on things. Things like aircraft carriers and rubble and recently flooded city squares. And that sends a strong message that no matter what happens to America, she will always rebound with the most powerfully staged photo ops in the world. Now, there may be an energy crisis. Well, this president has a very forward-thinking energy policy. Why do you think he's down on the ranch cutting that brush all the time? He's trying to create an alternative energy source. By 2008, we will have a mesquite-powered car. And I just like the guy. He's a good Joe. Obviously loves his wife. He calls her his better half. And polls show America agrees. And she's a true lady and a wonderful woman. But I just have one beef, ma'am. I'm sorry, but this reading initiative. I'm sorry, I've never been a fan of books. I don't trust them. They're all fact, no heart. I mean, they're elitists telling us what is or isn't true or what did or didn't happen. Who's Britannica to tell me the Panama Canal was built in 1914? If I want to say it was built in 1941, that's my right as an American. I'm with the president. Let history decide what did or did not happen. The greatest thing about this man Is he steady? You know where he stands. He believes the same thing Wednesday that he believed on Monday, no matter what happened Tuesday. Events can change. This man's beliefs never will. And as excited as I am to be here with the president, I am appalled to be surrounded by the liberal media that is destroying America, with the exception of Fox News. Fox News gives you both sides of every story, the president's side and the vice president's side. But the rest of you, what are you thinking? Reporting on NSA wiretapping or secret prisons in Eastern Europe? Those things are secret for a very important reason. They're super depressing. And if that's your goal, well, misery accomplished. Over the last 5 years, you people were so good. Over tax cuts, WMD intelligence, the effect of global warming, we Americans didn't want to know, and you had the courtesy not to try to find out. Those were good times, as far as we knew. But listen, let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction. Because really, what incentive do these people have to answer your questions after all? I mean, nothing satisfies you. Everybody asks for personnel changes. So, the White House has personnel changes. And then you write, oh, they're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. First of all, that is a terrible metaphor. This administration is not sinking. This administration is soaring. If anything, they are rearranging the deck chairs on the Hindenburg. Now, it's not all bad guys out there. There's some of the heroes out there tonight. Christopher Buckley, Jeff Sachs, Ken Burns, Bob Schieffer. I've interviewed all of them. By the way, Mr. President, thank you for agreeing to be on my show. I appreciate it. I was just as shocked as everyone here is. I promise you. How's Tuesday for you? I've got Frank Rich, but we can just bump him. And I mean bump him. I know a guy. Say the word. Let's see who we got here tonight. We got General Mosley, Air Force Chief of Staff. We've got General Peter Pace, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They still support Rumsfeld. Right, you guys aren't retired yet, right? Right, they still support Rumsfeld. Look, I've got a theory about how to handle these retired generals. I've caused all this trouble. Don't let them retire. Come on, we've got a stop-loss program. Let's use it on these guys. I've seen Nazini in that crowd on Wolf Blitzer. If you're strong enough to go on one of those pundit shows, you're strong enough to stand on a bank of computers and order men into battle. Come on. Jesse Jackson is here. The Reverend. Haven't heard from the Reverend in just a little while. I had him on the show. It was a very interesting interview, a very challenging interview. You can ask him anything, but he's going to say what he wants at the pace that he wants. It's like boxing a glacier. Enjoy that metaphor, by the way, because your grandchildren will have no idea what a glacier is. Justice Scalia is here. Justice Scalia, may I be the first to say, welcome, sir. You look fantastic. How are you? Just talking some Sicilian with my paisan. J- John McCain is here. John McCain, what a maverick. Somebody find out what fork he used on his salad. Because I guarantee you it wasn't a salad fork. This guy could have used a spoon. There's no predicting him. By the way, Senator McCain, so wonderful to see you coming back into the Republican fold. I've actually got a summer house in South Carolina. Look me up when you go to speak at Bob Jones University. So glad you've seen the light, sir. Mayor Nagin. Mayor Nagin is here from New Orleans, the chocolate city. Yeah, give it up. Mayor Nagin, I'd like to welcome you to Washington, D.C., the chocolate city with a marshmallow center. And a graham cracker crust of corruption. It's a Malamar, I guess is what I'm describing, is a Malamar. It's a seasonal cookie. Joe Wilson is here. Joe Wilson, right down here in front, the most famous husband since Desi Arnaz. And of course, he brought along his lovely wife, Valerie Plame. Oh my God. Oh, what have I said? Gee, Minetti, I am sorry, Mr. President. I meant to say he brought along his lovely wife, Joe Wilson's wife. Patrick Fitzgerald's not here tonight, right? Okay, dodged a bullet. And of course, we can't forget, man of the hour, new press secretary, Tony Snow. Secret Service name, Snow Job. Toughest job, what a hero, took the second toughest job in government, next to, of course, the ambassador to Iraq. Got some big shoes to fill, Tony, big shoes to fill. Scott McClellan could say nothing like nobody else. McClellan, of course, eager to retire, really, really felt like he needed to spend more time with Andrew Card's children. Then, Mr. President, I wish you hadn't made the decision so quickly, sir. I was vying for the job myself. I think I would have made a fabulous press secretary. I have nothing but contempt for these people.
Stephen Colbert addressing the White House Correspondents Association annual dinner. He was speaking right next to President Bush, who was sitting at his side. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Maté, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin and Megan Whitney. On Saturday and Friday night, we'll be at the University of California, Davis, for a discussion of Guantanamo with Professor Al McCoy from the University of Wisconsin, wrote A Question of Torture, and also with Chaplain Joseph Yi, who is the Muslim chaplain who was arrested at Guantanamo. Ultimately, all charges against him dropped. Also, Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights will be there as we talk about the issue of detention of prison camps and Guantanamo and beyond. You can go to our website to get transcripts of our broadcasts, video and audio podcasts, and for links to all the organizations that we cover. That website, again, is democracynow.org. You can also sign up there for our daily digest, our daily headlines and news reports at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!